she would be just as compromised if these reeking deadheads dragged the purse off her shoulder and found the concealed shrack burst transmitter as she would if FSB had. The three were whip-thin and malnourished, but Dominica knew they would be quick and able to absorb punishment. It would be critical to keep them off her. She would trap the lead attacker with a joint hold and drag him in circles to keep him in front of the other two. She would use the keys to rake their eyes, then sweep their legs with her foot and stomp a high heel into their throats or temples. That was the plan, at least. "Suka, bitch, give me your purse," said number one, stepping toward her front right. They were indistinguishable from one another, simply incoming threats. Their yellow halos mingled and matched the color of their crooked teeth. "Bliad, whore, did you hear?" said number two, coming in front left. Dominica stepped slightly right as number one reached out to grab her. He smelled sour, urine, beer, tobacco, and pigsty. She covered the top of his right hand with her left hand and bent his wrist down and back. He howled as Dominica pivoted with him to the left, blocking number two, then continued pivoting to swing number one on his toes with pain into number three in a tangle of legs and arms. She held on to number one's wrist and turned him again into number two, foreheads cracking together. Number three was coming in fast, his arm raised above his head. Knife. Leaning back, Dominica turned number one into the line of the downward slash. The blade flensed down the side of number one's shaved head and cut his ear off at the root. Dominica let the bellowing number one drop to the ground, holding his head, his neck black with spurting blood. She instantly stepped forward with a corkscrew punch, driving the three keys clamped between her right knuckles into the right eye of number three, feeling ocular fluid spurt over the back of her hand. She raked the keys out of the eye socket across his nose and into his left eye, a glancing blow. Maybe he'd still be able to see out of that eye later. Number three collapsed, shrieking, "Suka," covering his bloody face with trembling hands. It had taken 3 seconds, and two of them were on the pavement writhing amid gouts of spattered blood, but number two was almost on her, and she knew if he knocked her down, all three would swarm her, maddened by their pain, and slam her skull against the concrete until they saw gray brains in the streetlight. Without thinking, Dominica dipped her shoulder as she grabbed the leather handles of her purse and swung it in a flat arc into the left temple of number two. The 4 pounds of steel-bodied shrack component sewn into the bottom of the tote bag hit skull bone with a flat metallic sound. Number two wobbled and sat down with a thump cross-eyed. Breathing hard, Dominica looked at them on the sidewalk, one face down and unconscious, the other curled up and whimpering, the third still sitting up, staring but not seeing. These three roaches had come close to ruining everything, to exposing her, to sending her to the basement room in Butyrka prison with the pine log wall designed to catch ricochets and the drains in the sloping brown-stained cement floor placed to sluice away the fluids of the executed prisoners. 5 years of unimaginable risks, of narrow escapes, of precious intelligence, measured in linear feet, passed to the Americans, of countless meetings and countless safe houses, only to be nearly unseated by three besotted Gopniki, 2 blocks from her apartment. This was another charming part of her Russia, too, these louts who were as indolent and cruel and predatory as Putin's inner circle sitting in the jeweled halls of the Kremlin. They were the same cancer. She risked her life, and tonight they had almost ended it. She could be in a freezing cell, awash with sewage, or dead and staring out of a cardboard coffin with a cloth tied under her jaw to keep her mouth closed. These animals. In a rage, Dominica stepped up to the dazed punk, set her feet and swung her stiffened arm under his chin and into his throat, a Spetsnaz killing stroke, fracturing the hyoid bone and rupturing the larynx. He fell backwards and began gasping, eyes staring at the top of the trees.
"Ublyudok, bastard," said Dominica, watching his legs jerk.
She was still shaking so badly 3 minutes later that the sticky apartment key skittered over the lock before she could open the door with 2 hands. She left the lights off except for a small lamp near the front door. Her skirt was spotted with something dark and wet. The Shrak message downloaded to her laptop blinked once, flashed green for 2 seconds. She read the word Istanbul. Then it went black, with the words Error 5788 appearing on the screen. Shut, damn it. The Gopnik's head apparently was harder than the components. Now she would have to trigger a cringingly dangerous personal meeting with an officer from Moscow Station. Why couldn't Nate come to meet her? To exchange the damaged equipment for a new Shrak set. She left her clothes in a pile on the floor, kicked off her shoes, and looked at herself in the mirror. The skin between her knuckles had been torn by the keys, and her hand throbbed. The little lamp cast a shadow over the curves of her body. 5 years was a long time. Her figure was softer now, her rib cage didn't show, and her breasts were fuller. Thank God her stomach was still flat and her hips had not spread to all points of the compass. The French bikini wax had been a silly impulse, but she was getting used to it. She was satisfied that her legs and ankles were slim. Looking at herself suddenly deformed into an out-of-body dream. The image in the mirror was someone else. An unbearable melancholy washed over her. She stifled a sob, momentarily overwhelmed by her situation, by tonight's danger, and by her whole existence as a spy. Look at you, she thought. What are you doing? Who are you? A ridiculous fanatic fighting alone in the dark, overwhelming dangers arrayed against you, the odds of surviving slim, your friends far away, separated from the man you love. How long will you last? How did her mentor, General Korchnoi, he spied for CIA for 14 years, summon the will and determination to keep going? Dominica blinked as tears slid down the cheeks of the revenant in the mirror. It wasn't her. It was someone else crying. Siulama de Puy, Ioana's chicken with mushroom supreme sauce. Cut chicken into small pieces, boil in salted water with rough-cut carrot and onion until tender. Make a supreme sauce by melting butter, then stir in flour, add chicken stock, egg yolk, and sour cream to make a velvety sauce. Sauté thin-sliced mushrooms in butter, add to the sauce, and finish cooking without boiling. Add chicken pieces, chopped parsley, season, and simmer. Serve with Russian mashed potatoes. Mix mashed potatoes with sour cream, heavy cream, egg yolks, dill, and butter. Spread half of potatoes on a greased pan, layer with caramelized onions, cover with remaining potatoes, and top with sour cream. Bake uncovered. Chapter 7. Pole Star of Humanity. Two aides escorted her down the brilliantly lighted corridor while Dominica composed her features for a last-minute meeting with Gorelikov. Probably routine, but she always half expected the room would be full of security goons gathered there to arrest her. The life of a spy. She was on the third floor, residential wing of the Senate building, where Lenin and Stalin had both maintained comfortable apartments and where Stalin's second wife, Nadezhda Aliluyeva, in 1932 committed suicide. With a revolver, probably, thought Dominica, after she realized she was married to the messenger of Lucifer on Earth. An aide knocked on a plain wooden door, waited a beat, and then indicated that she should go in. Anton Gorelikov stood from behind the desk in his Kremlin office, a corner room on the north angle of the three-sided Senate building. The office was spacious, lined with bookcases and richly carpeted in deep red. An ornate crystal chandelier hung from the center of the ceiling. Gorelikov's desk was littered with papers and folders in assorted colors. How many other operations are you hatching around the world? Dominica thought. Today Gorelikov wore a blue shadow plaid suit by Kiton and a light blue shirt by Maste Ferretti and a black knit Gitman Brothers tie. He was more elegant than a London banker. No match for the damp tubs of suet on the Kremlin Security Council. "Ready for your trip?" Gorelikov said, arms outstretched in greeting, like a grandfather welcoming a grandchild back home for spring break. Dominica shook his hand and sat gingerly in a plush leather chair in front of his desk, crossed her legs and told herself not to bounce her foot. Gorelikov had read Dominica's New York Ops proposal,
a document outlining alias identity, clandestine travel, and meeting protocols with the illegal, which she had wired directly to him last night from SVR headquarters in Yasenevo via an embargoed privacy channel. Excellent plan, Colonel. Excellent tradecraft, quite satisfactory. He beamed at her as the blue halo around his head shone and pulsed. Strange. He normally didn't vibrate like this. Gorelikov had some other villainy in mind, she was sure of it. Sergeant Blokin is making his own travel arrangements, and he will contact you on arrival. He will lightly counter-surveil for you in New York City, but will not, repeat, not accompany you to the meeting with Susan the illegal. I made that quite clear to him and Major Shlikov both. If you have any trouble with Blokin following instructions, abort the meeting rather than risk Susan. Dominika nodded, thinking how in the world she could stop Blokin from doing anything he wanted to do. Her self-defense moves in Sistema could not match his brute strength. Dominika had done a little research on Iosip Blokin. He had served 5 years in Afghanistan, where in his 20s he led the Spetsnaz Storm 333 assault in 1979 on the Tajbeg Palace to depose Afghan President Hafizullah Amin, killing more than 200 presidential bodyguards. Unofficial reports documented that he had hung the naked body of the president's mistress from the balustrade of the palace balcony as a message to the people of Kabul. The Soviets were now in town. Blokin then reportedly swung the president's 5-year-old son by the heels against the wall, resolving any questions regarding primogeniture. But Blokin was neither a hallucinating veteran nor a psychotic executioner. Dominika was surprised to read that after the war, Blokin completed non-commissioned officers' command school, trained with fraternal special forces units abroad, learned Vietnamese, and wrote a well-received article on small unit tactics that had been accepted and included in a classified edition of the newsletter of the Center for Analysis of Strategies and Technologies in Frun's Military Academy. And he showed black bat wings of evil, savage or savant. She'd have to take care. Blokin and Gorelikov, two ends of the spectrum. Dominika looked out the curtained window over the crenellations onto Red Square and the onion domes of St. Basil's Cathedral and the just-visible roof of Lenin's mausoleum, hard against the Kremlin wall. The wax mummy of V.I. Lenin, under glass in that flowered bier, no longer influenced events in Novorossiya, Putin's new Russia. But she wondered whether Gorelikov stood at this window and telepathically communed with Lenin and the other visionaries in repose just below in the Kremlin necropolis. Suslov, Dzerzhinsky, Brezhnev, Andropov, and Stalin, the Vosged, the master of mayhem. Did they speak to him from the grave? Did they coach him in the tenets of deceit and betrayal? Gorelikov found the folder and came around his desk to sit beside Dominika in a matching armchair. They spent the next 2 hours discussing the mission, which Dominika did not need. She could put together an ops plan in her sleep. No, this was Gorelikov co-opting her, drawing her close, offering his affinity and support, she knew. She remembered what Benford had once told her about Kremlin allegiances. Soviet officials used to say that the beginning of one's ruin was the day one became Stalin's favorite. Gorelikov gazed up and thought at the chandelier above his head as Dominika spoke. Like every chandelier in the Kremlin, it was wired with a tiny 24-bit 48 kilohertz digital microphone in the babesh, the fluted glass cup from which the crystal pendants hung, so she was speaking to the president at the same time. She would fly from Paris to Toronto and travel by rail on the Maple Leaf down the Hudson River Valley. U.S. immigration controls were not as stringent at train stations as at airports. The next matter of business, communications. Dominika's primary mission was to pass two special 256-bit encrypted echo phones to Susan, designed by Line T to synchronize only with each other, and to defy geolocation by frequency hopping simultaneously between cell towers. Susan would give one of the phones to Magnet during a personal meet, and the secure commo link would be established. With the delivery of the echo phones, Magnet henceforth would communicate only with Susan, an untraceable person, an anonymous American citizen unknown to the FBI or CIA. Even if personal meetings occasionally were necessary, security would be preserved. During her time in the United States, Dominica would have no way securely to communicate with the Kremlin from an official installation. The resident in New York City at the Russian consulate on East 91st Street was not briefed and would be unaware of Dominica's presence in the city. She would be on her own, a point that displeased Shlikov and moved him to insist that Blokhin stay close. Not likely, she thought. Gorelikov handed Dominica an envelope with a description of a meeting site located on an island off the coast of New York City called Staten. An island? Asked Dominica. How do I get there to meet Susan? Gorelikov flipped through the pages. There apparently is a ferry boat to this Staten Island from Manhattan. The illegal knows how to operate in the city. I'm sure the site is secure. He handed Dominica a small black-and-white ID photo of Susan, and Dominica was surprised to see an attractive blonde woman with reading glasses. This officer has been in the United States since the late 90s. She is a top pro, our best illegal. Her legend is impenetrable, said Gorelikov, reading from the folder. She has a position of influence. She is an editor at one of the top liberal magazines in Manhattan, widely known and respected in her profession. Her colleagues are totally unsuspecting. They have no idea they have been working beside an SVR officer all these years. It is perfect cover. If necessary, you may initiate contact by calling Susan's sterile number from your non-attributable cell phone, but only in an emergency. Conversely, if I want to send you a message via Susan, she, in turn, can trigger a meeting by calling you. Here are the numbers, recognition paroles, and meeting schedules. Simple, straightforward. Dominica tried to palm the photo. Benford would sell his firstborn to get his hands on Susan, but Gorelikov took it back. You'll receive a full trip report, said Dominica, after I brief Gable and Benford. With her Schrack transmitter damaged by the Gopnik's skull, Dominica would have to wait until she arrived in New York to rendezvous with her handlers and tell them these details. I have every confidence in you, said Gorelikov, looking at his watch, an elegant, wafer-thin Audemars Piguet millinery quadrennium, with an open-work face, the intricate movement visible, like Gorelikov's mind, minutely whirring, oscillating, and pendulating. New York, New York. It was a dream. Dominica, in French alias Sybil Clenard, flew from Paris to Toronto, then rode the slow maple leaf train down the scenic Hudson Valley, stirring the American Gothic ghosts of Sleepy Hollow and drowsy Dutchmen. Dominica had researched the city and was excited to see it all. On the train, U.S. border agents didn't look twice at her, and she had felt no fear. Pulling her suitcase across the concourse at Penn Station felt like home, but there were more people on the Moscow metro and the stations were grander. This rather grubby underground terminal couldn't compare with the magnificent Kievskaya station on the Arbat line, with its mosaics and chandeliers. There were shops and music here. A man with a hat was dancing for tips, and an old woman stopped and started dancing with him. Americans. Russians were more reserved, more serious, and they dressed up to go out in the city. These New Yorkers were half naked. Dominica trudged up the stairs, pushed through the doors, came out onto the street and stopped, frozen. The roar of the city enveloped her like a wave. The traffic on 7th Avenue like a river in flood. The sun blotted out by the buildings, towering, majestic glass canyons, filling the sky in all directions. An impossible concentration of them, and their mass pressed down on her. Dominica craned her neck to look up at them like a Derevinchina, a hayseed from the country not caring. To be sure, Moscow was a city, so too Paris, Rome, London, Athens. But nothing like this. This was some place without equal, electric and buzzing, a pole star of humanity. Dominica was like a mouse inside a violin, claws gripping tight, stunned by noise and surrounded by vibration. She shook her head. She knew the name and address of her hotel, had memorized the walking route there, and she needed to find a secure telephone to call Braddock. But first she wanted to walk, to see everything. This great city was America. This energy, this industry, this overarching freedom. This is what she aspired to for Russia. This is why she was spying for CIA, and this defined her neutro, the impossible-to-explain Russian concept of a person's inner being. She threaded through pedestrians on the sidewalk, and as if to match the frenzy of these streets, unrelated thoughts came to her voli nevoli, all in a rush. My God, how do you check for opposition coverage on these streets? Was the shashlik from these food trucks edible? Did they have gobniki, street toughs in New York? It would be impossible to pick out surveillance in this crush of bobbing heads, faces of every color and every ethnicity, appraising eyes, twitching hands, and shuffling feet. Overhead, a fog bank of people's colors, indistinguishable, useless, was overwhelming. As chief of Line KR counterintelligence, she knew how her colleagues in the New York Residentura blithely reported managing operations on these streets. She'd reported it all to Benford for the last 5 years, but now, seeing it firsthand, she knew the truth. That's why the center uses illegals here for the really sensitive cases, she thought. Who could find surveillance in this woodwork? The Jane Hotel in the West Village was something out of a movie, chosen for her by Gorelikov for its small size and anonymity. An annoyingly voluble bellhop at the front desk had grinned at her, Russians reserved smiling for their friends and family members, to smile with no reason is a sign of a fool, and insisted on telling her that the hotel had been a sailor's boarding house at the turn of the century, and that survivors of the Titanic in 1912 had recuperated here. Dominica thanked him, then ignored him. The lobby was high Victorian, a riot of colored mosaic pilasters and leafy palms and tarnished copper kettles. The bar lounge was bohemian crazy, filled with 1,000 candles, velveteen upholstered couches, zebra print armchairs, a brown leather hippo, and toffee-colored, stuffed bighorn sheep with a cowbell around its neck, standing high atop the fireplace lintel. It would be fun to seduce Nate in this hideaway. Walking down the dim wainscoted corridor to her room, she felt the shipwrecked spirits of 1912 around her. As she fumbled with her key card, an old woman in a woolen suit and matching pillbox hat came out of a room at the end of the corridor. Under the ridiculous hat, her white hair was up in a bun, and she wore half-moon glasses. She shuffled soundlessly toward Dominica on the threadbare carpet, her right hand running along the wooden wall panels for balance. Dominica flattened against the wall to make space for the biddy to pass. Behind the glasses, the old woman's eyes locked onto Dominica's for a second. They were the color of amber. Hunter's eyes, wolf's eyes, raptor's eyes. A strong blue aura around her head. Cunning, calculation, deception. What was the staruka, the old crone, looking at? She didn't belong in this trendy hotel, either. Dominica suddenly knew. They were watching her. This old woman was a bird dog to report that Dominica had arrived. The magnet case was running on many different levels. The old lady slowly disappeared around a corner. Dominica's room was train compartment narrow with a ship's berth instead of a bed. She imagined making love with Nate in this little room, her foot braced on the far wall for purchase. She left her suitcase and purse on the bed, stuffed the echo phones, a small snap wallet with money, and her own mobile phone into a shoulder bag which she zipped shut. She must not lose the phones to be delivered to Susan. The old lady in the hallway was a wake-up call. Dominica had no doubt that they would use her personal phone to track her movements as well as hotwire it to listen to her conversations. Into the other coat pocket she clipped the fat ballpoint pen with pointed metal tip, a tactical fighting spike. That was her only weapon. She hit the street, wanting to get away before Blokin appeared, determined to clear her sick so she could call Braddock. Never mind the FBI, now she had to worry about Gorelikov's tricks, her own countrymen following her. Did Gorelikov's vlianye, his influence, extend to the streets of New York? Who would they be, the people checking up on her? Well, she had survived this long spying for Nate and the others and wasn't about to be played. As she left the hotel and walked east, she put on the big fashion sunglasses that were designed by the boys in Line T, with beveled mirrors ground into the outer edges of each lens, which permitted a limited view behind her. You didn't rely on such toys. Detecting coverage on the street was much more complicated, but it did not hurt to have them. Dominica walked for 3 hours, searching for and finding relatively quiet side streets, stripping away repeats, possibles, ghosts, and suspects. If her cell phone was beaconed and her route plotted later, she would be guilty only of executing a thorough and professional surveillance detection run. She used Union Square as a surveillance trap, knowing that any team scurries to cover exits along all sides of a park and inadvertently show themselves. She scanned the outer edges of the park, nothing. She plowed up endless, bustling Fifth Avenue, the Empire State Building coming closer with each block, beckoning bigger, taller, and somehow more substantial than the Vistoki, Stalin's Gothic Seven Sisters skyscrapers in Moscow. Nothing showed behind her. Occasional switches to the other side of the street revealed no telltale behavior of handing off the eye. She reversed her direction by taking a taxi south past the Washington Square Arch, bailing out and walking through the urban campus of New York University to detect pedestrians who stood out among younger casual students. Nothing. Dominica popped into the Smile restaurant on Bond Street. She liked the look of the weathered boards on the ceiling and the rich brick walls, and asked to use the phone behind the bar, explaining in an exaggerated French accent to the skeptical barmaid in a dirty apron that she was from France and that her mobile phone did not receive service in New York. "Besides, I'm calling my CIA handler to discuss foiling a Kremlin attack on the political and security foundations of America, with the express goal of preserving your gravy-stained way of life." She left her phone in her coat pocket and hung the coat on a wall hook away from the bar. Braddock answered on the first ring. She told him about her cell phone and the old lady at the hotel, his low chuckle reassuring and comforting. He kept his comments short and cryptic. They'd reviewed meeting procedures 100 times.
5 o'clock, go to the museum and wait outside. Got it? I'll be looking out for you."
The line went dead. Gable had just told Dominica to rendezvous with him at the Monkey Bar at 3 o'clock. The Power Lunch restaurant was renowned for the iconic celebrity murals on its walls, hence the museum. Gable had also cryptically told her she'd be counter-surveilled as she walked to the restaurant on East 54th Street. She wondered whether it would be the old team again, whether she'd see Nate's slim features across the street, whether she'd hear his voice, and whether he'd sit beside her close enough to touch him, feel the heat of his body, smell him. Stop it. Gable was chewing an unlit cigar and driving a wheezing, beat-up sedan with torn plastic seats and an Orthodox cross hanging by a plastic chain from the rearview mirror. The officers from Benford CID counter-surveilling Dominica gave Gable the all-clear, and he had pulled up, thrown open the passenger door, and scooped her off the sidewalk in front of the Monkey Bar. Once rolling, he put fingers to his lips, nodding at the cell phone in her hand. He made 2 violent right turns, narrowly missed a pedestrian, and careered through the crosstown traffic at high speed, shooting the gaps between taxis, trucks, and buses. After 1 near collision, Dominica reached up, grabbed the swinging cross, and theatrically kissed it. Gable winked at her, delighted. He ran a red light and cut left across oncoming traffic to turn onto 9th Avenue in the direction of Dominica's hotel. In classic alteration of surveillance detection run, SDR pace, Gable now drove south slowly in the right lane, letting honking, gesticulating New York drivers pass him. They were black, no tails. After 10 blocks, he swerved to the curb in front of a dingy storefront restaurant with Turkish cuisine written in a faux mosaic over the door. He gestured for Dominica to leave her phone under the seat and follow him into the restaurant. The place was dark and cozy, with copper trays and ceramic nazarlik, blue evil eye talismans mounted on the walls. Gable ordered a choban salad, two kebabs, and kimali ishbanek, sautéed ground beef, spinach, and rice.
"You'll love it," said Braddock. "Nash and I used to eat it at a Turkish joint in Helsinki."
"Helsinki," said Dominika, staring. "Skolkolet, skolkozim. So many summers, so many winters. It seems like a million years ago."
Gable looked at her while chewing a piece of bread. "Yeah, we've all come a long way, you most of all," said Gable. "Now tell me what's going on."
Dominika sat back and talked fast. She told him about Gorelikov's instructions and the meeting with Susan. She showed him the Echo phones. They would not be hot-wired if they were meant for an illegal, thinking he'd want Tex to take them apart to inspect, but Gable shook his head.
"They could be trapped to reveal tampering, and you're the only one who holds them."
Dominika described the meeting site on Staten Island.
"You know how to take the ferry?"
"I studied the entire route. I know how to get there," said Dominika.
"This illegal, what's she look like?" said Gable.
Dominika shrugged. "It was a little black-and-white photo," said Dominika. "Blonde, reading glasses, steely blue eyes, short hair."
Gable rubbed his face. "Christ," he said. "A top illegal in the city and we can't ID her. How many more of them out there, I wonder?"
"There is no way of knowing," said Dominika. "Line S, the External Illegals Department, and Line N, the officers who handle them in-country, are compartmented from the rest of the service, even from me and KR.
The food came to the table and Gable spooned a mound of glistening spinach onto Dominica's plate. She tried a forkful. It was a savory combination of sautéed spinach and curried ground beef with a hint of rice. Delicious. And Nate used to eat it.
The question popped out before she could stop herself. "Braddock, where is Nate? What is he doing?" said Dominika.
Gable put down his fork. "Benford sent him to take care of another op in Asia. Right now, that boy is busier than a cat covering crap on a marble floor. He'll be back in a couple weeks. You steamed at him again?"
Gable just asked questions, no matter how sensitive. Dominika smiled. "In Russia, we say, nalomat drov, to mangle the firewood.
You say to mess something up?
That's our love affair, messed up."
Gable patted her hand. "I'm not supposed to say this to you," said Gable. "But you should either cut it off with him once and for all or defect and concentrate on your lives together. Maybe recruit your replacement before you go. Loving each other and spying at the same time is going to get someone hurt."
Dominika was silent. She knew Gable understood her.
"Don't tell anyone I told you that," he said, smiling. Then he got back to business. "You gotta fly straight with that Spetsnaz guy hanging around. Let him see you nice and relaxed," Dominika nodded. "Make the meeting with that gal on Staten Island alone, but otherwise keep him close. He's gonna file a trip report, and you want them all to think you were never out of pocket. We'll meet once more after your meet with the illegal and try to get some ID on her without being too obvious." Gable waved to a young man at a table across the room, and Lucius Westfall walked over.
"This droopy bit of wet wool is Westfall," said Gable. "He's backup if you see him on the street, here to help you and me if we need it."
Dominika smiled and shook his hand, noting a blue halo quivering with nervousness. She felt sorry for him, especially since she knew what a bear Gable could be.
"Glad to meet you, Westfall," said Dominika.
He nodded wordlessly, obviously overcome at meeting the famous diva. He'd had no idea she was so beautiful. He turned and left the restaurant after an awkward final bow.
"Braddock, you do not torment him too much, do you? He's so young, like you were once."
Gable grunted. "I was born old. But tell me more about the Spetsnaz sergeant."
"This man, Blokin, is worse than either Zhuganov or Maturin. He is intelligent, but behind the eyes are, how do you say, hot rocks, like when you grill shashlik."
"Like hot coals? Well, don't arm wrestle him," said Gable.
"I'm forcing myself to go with him to an event at the Hilton on 6th Avenue in 2 days. A Russian journalist, Daria Repina, is speaking at a Free Russia Fund event. She is a loud critic of everything Putin does. She is without fear, but now that she is in America raising money, it will become dangerous for her.
Is it smart for you to be going to something like that? Why would a Spetsnaz snake eater want to go to hear some dissident? Said Gable.
Attending with him will be a good appearance. I mean bona fides, for me, said Dominika. It is a public event. I will stay in the background and leave early. As for Blokin, I think he is curious, like a dog sniffing a lamppost. It will be his last night in New York. We both return separately to Moscow the next day.
And when you get back, you find out the name of Magnet fast as you can, right?
Someone will make a slip. I will hear the name eventually, said Dominika.
That's all well and good, but we gotta wrap Magnet up before then, preferably before you're briefed on the case, before you're officially told his name. How's it gonna look if he gets arrested the very weekend you're read in? Plus, that prick is selling secrets wholesale, so let's blow him up ASAP.
There is a problem. Dominika told Gable about the malfunction with her Shrack transmitter after she had brained the street mugger. Gable shook his head.
We wondered why you hadn't sent anything for a week. I told him you had a boyfriend and wouldn't get out of bed.
Nekopterny, she said, crude and rude.
Damn it. Bad time to lose your commo, said Gable. I'll cable the station to get you another set. You want them to cash it or do a personal meet?
If you have a good station officer who won't bring surveillance with him, a personal meet is faster than me digging up a package in the forest. There are 5 new brief encounter sites left in the inventory that are still good.
You sure? I'd rather break 1 nail using a shovel than have 10 nails pulled out in a prison basement, said Gable. One normally did not remind agents about being captured and tortured, but Gable and Dominika dealt with each other on a different plane.
Braddock, that is because you are delicate and sensitive, said Dominika.
He fucking got that right, said Gable, as he signaled for the bill.
Kimali Hispanic, Turkish sautéed spinach. Sauté finely chopped onion in olive oil and butter. Add ground beef and cook until brown. Add diced tomatoes, red pepper paste, tomato sauce, and a handful of rinsed rice. Season and stir to incorporate. Layer coarsely chopped spinach on top. Cover and cook on medium heat until spinach is wilted and rice is tender. Serve with a dollop of yogurt and crusty country bread. Chapter 8. To Shoo a Flea. Dominika sat on the upper deck of the crowded, lumbering Staten Island ferry, drolly appraising the collection of people lining the rail. They looked primarily like tourists, talking about, pointing at, and photographing the receding skyline of Manhattan. They would then rush to the starboard rail to snap the Statue of Liberty, then stampede back to gawk at a vintage, gaff-rigged schooner tacking up the bay. They honked like a flock of geese. They were dressed in shorts, t-shirts, and brassiere tops, and wore boots, sneakers, shoes, and sandals, a bizarre tribe that rasped at Dominika's Russian sensibilities. She was dressed in a light cotton summer print dress with fashionable flats and carried a beige over-the-shoulder bag. She wore her line tee sunglasses. Despite the raucous passengers, she thought these ferries were a marvel, big orange birthday cakes that never stopped crisscrossing the bay, nothing like the belching shark-nosed hydrofoils that skimmed across Lake Ladoga from St. Petersburg. She literally had been swept down the ferry boarding ramp by the crush of laughing, excited New Yorkers, past placid, bomb-sniffing dogs, and was able to find a quiet seat along the outside rail where she enjoyed the salt breeze and thought about today's meeting with the illegal, Susan. She had returned to her hotel room last night and felt the rubber band around her doorknob, a signal confirming a meeting at the site on Staten Island tomorrow afternoon. Dominika wondered if the old lady down the hall had snapped the band in place. She had reviewed the memorized drill, the surveillance detection route she would take, ferry boat, Staten Island train, walking route up to and through the sprawling Moravian cemetery on Todd Hill,
and final approach to the site, which was inside the ornate mausoleum of Gilded Age billionaire Cornelius Vanderbilt, constructed in 1886 and secluded in a private wooded corner of the park. She had studied the satellite images and memorized the way along the lanes that wound through the 45 hectares of the graveyard, and knew she could find her way to the site at the appointed time without coverage. God knew who she had to worry about more on the street during this insane operation, Russians, the illegal, or the FBI. Gable had been right. Moscow had moved fast. This call-out for the meeting with the illegal came less than 48 hours after Dominica had arrived in New York. Dominica could imagine the hurried consultation between Gorelikov and Putin in the Kremlin, their quiet voices briefly discussing options and then the stoic, blue-eyed nod validating whatever tactics Gorelikov suggested to enable the contact. Dominica immediately had gone back out and called Gable from a public phone at a nearby bar to tell him that lunch was on tomorrow. Gable told her to stay cool, that everything she did or said would get back to the men who would be evaluating her. They agreed to meet after Dominica returned to Manhattan. A swarthy young man leaning against the ferry rail in front of Dominica was obviously a local from Staten Island, dressed in a sports jersey, his dark hair slicked back. He noticed Dominica and came to sit beside her on the plastic-molded seat. He flirted, charming and irreverent, his face close, pointing out landmarks as the ferry plowed across New York Harbor, including the arching Verrazano Narrows Bridge. He called it the Guinea Gangplank, although it was unclear to Dominica why, connecting the two boroughs of Brooklyn and Staten Island. Dominica could understand about half of what he said, but smiled and looked where he pointed. When she told him she was from France, he winked at her and knowingly said, "Nice wines." The thrumming of the ferryboat engines moderated, then the deck shook as the engines were put full astern to ease the nose of the ferry into the exit ramp at St. George Terminal on Staten Island. Time to go, time to turn on, time to go to work. Dominica slung her bag over her shoulder and nodded vaguely to the young man. Moving quickly, she followed the signs to the adjacent rail platform to board the southbound train. Quick checks to either side did not pick up the loitering passenger, or the too long look from the young woman on the sidewalk, or the ticket clerk diving for the phone. No coverage, she thought, as she stepped into a train car. As the doors closed, Dominica saw with annoyance that the young man had boarded the next car and was staring at her through the window of the connecting door. She didn't have time for this, a Romeo following her, thinking he might get lucky with a hot tourist from France. The train rattled and swayed and stopped frequently at suburban stations. A different world was unraveling in front of Dominica's eyes on each side of the tracks. Commercial areas had petrol stations on every corner. There were supermarkets with tomatoes stacked on display in front, and she counted restaurant after restaurant, most of them claiming they made the best pizza in New York. Was this even New York City? The train clanked past working-class neighborhoods of tidy two-story houses, shingled with lean-to greenhouses and tiny fenced yards, some of which had curious above-ground swimming pools, hardly big enough to hold a person. On every roof was a gray satellite TV dish, all pointed up in the same direction. The houses were nothing like the luxurious dachas of the Siloviki. These were not rich people, but these houses looked comfortable. The cars parked along the street were big and relatively new. If this was not wealth, it was at least prosperity on a wide scale. In Russia, they would say, "Blagopulchiye," bread buttered on both sides, well-being. Not many people, not even in Moscow, were living lives with such possessions, with such abundant food. Her countrymen struggled to survive. They despaired of improving their lives. They dared not think grand thoughts or speak the truth. They could not choose. Dominica had memorized the strange names of the train stations. Grasmere, Old Town, Dongan Hills, Jefferson Avenue, Grant City. People bustled on and off as the train doors opened and closed. No observable surveillance behavior, nothing amiss. She could see the young man in the next car watching her through the glass. The next station was her waypoint,
New Dorp, where she had to get off. She stepped out to the platform and quickly walked in the middle of a crowd of passengers up the steep exit staircase to street level and onto a broad boulevard with light traffic. On the opposite corner stood an Italian bakery owned by someone named Dominic. "Perhaps I will have a bakery someday named Dominica's," she thought. "Idiot, you don't know how to bake." She went inside, assaulted by the heavy aroma of fresh bread, noting there were no lines at the counter, was no one screaming for service, no churlish salesperson cursing at customers. She bought something called a calzone, which looked like an oversized ciborecchi, a Russian meat pie. This calzone was baked golden brown with a fluted edge and was served with a small cup of tomato sauce. Dominica sat at one of a few tables by the window and checked the street. The persistent Romeo was loitering on the opposite sidewalk, smoking, an American gopnik, but he didn't look as tough as the Moscow species. Boj, God, she didn't need this distraction right now. The mixture of sausage, peppers, and onions inside the calzone was delectable and oozed out, and she wiped her mouth with a paper napkin. Isobilie, she thought, abundance. This was an American neighborhood bakery, not a state store, one of hundreds in this borough alone. Enough. Get moving. Dominica walked up New Dorp Lane, the sidewalks broad and clean, people in storefront offices working. A corner food market, the Convenient Mart, whatever that meant, had cases of bottled water stacked high on either side of the door. The young man was still following her, and she knew she had to shake him before she neared the cemetery. The illegal might be observing her approach, and it would be a disaster if she couldn't get rid of him. As she was entering the store in an effort to shake him off, Dominica heard footsteps, and the young man called, "Hey, mamselle!" And she turned to see Romeo take a picture of her with his cell phone at a distance of 5 feet, then hold it up to admire. Besides her official academy photo and the ID pics Gable had taken of her in Helsinki and Ops alias passport photos, there was no extant photograph of SVR Colonel Dominica Igorova, especially not on the mobile phone of some Durak, some idiot in front of the Convenient Mart on New Dorp Lane on Staten Island 40 minutes before a clandestine contact with an illegals officer. She'd be on this boy's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter accounts in 3 minutes. Dominica made an instant calculation. "Since you seem so intent on following me," said Dominica to him, "perhaps you can show me a good bottle of American wine in this store." The young man stepped up to her, exuding his snail trail charm. "Show you a bottle of wine, or share it with you?" he cooed. Dominica let a slight smile move her lips. "It depends how good the wine is," she said. The young man led her into the little market down a food aisle where Dominica stopped in amazement to count no fewer than 10 different types of breakfast cereals on the shelf, an impossible riot of color. She followed Romeo to the back of the store and stood in front of a wine cooler with sliding glass doors, while Romeo pointed out the reds, then the whites. They had everything, anything she wanted. Almaden, Gallo, Carlo Rossi, Blue Nun, Lancers. He said the Franzia box wines were underrated. If she didn't like any of the wines, they had pints behind the counter. Gin, vodka, rye. Dominica chose a white and let Romeo pay, then followed him across the avenue to sit on a step that was part of a cement bridge that carried ribbed steam heat pipes over the commuter train tracks and was screened from the main road. The cement bridge shook when a train passed beneath. Blokin would have driven the tactical spike through Romeo's eye and into his brain, but Dominica took a sip from the bottle. The wine was sweet and metallic, then handed it back. She turned and hit him on the side of his neck with a hammer fist that started down by her left hip and snapped around with torque provided by her hips. The strike overloaded the nerves in his mastoid process, and his head slumped forward as he pitched unconscious, face first, onto the concrete. If he wasn't dead, he would be out for several hours, and Dominica would be long rid of Staten Island. She fished Romeo's phone out of his back pocket and used a broken, pointed chunk of concrete as a Paleolithic tool to pulverize the modern appliance into plastic crumbles, none remotely recognizable as a phone. She scattered the smithereens onto the tracks under the bridge, took a final vile sip from the bottle, and threw that, too, to smash on the rail bed among all the detritus piled along the tracks.
"Zvezda, big shot," said Dominika, looking down at Romeo, knowing it would have been easier and more secure to have killed him.
She wondered if she would eventually get to that point, the Blokin-Stalin default solution, kill and erase the obstacle regardless of circumstances. Moving quickly, Dominika turned right onto Richmond Road and walked uphill past houses with painted fences and trimmed bushes. Many of the houses had American flags hanging from the porches. The street was quiet. She was black. There was no trailing coverage, she was sure. She was a Russian intelligence officer loose in America, proceeding to a meeting with a sleeper agent. The temperature was mild, the sky was clear, the sunlight was bright. The ornamental gate to the Moravian Cemetery was open, flanked by lush orange trumpet vines. As if she had visited this graveyard every weekend, Dominika unerringly took the left-hand path, walked past the placid lake, its surface stirred by the drooping branchlets of willows. She continued along the paved drive flanked on either side by acres of tombstones. Some of the stone markers were extravagant, 20-foot obelisks or ziggurats topped by ecstatic angels. She passed rows of small ornate mausoleums protruding out of grassy tumuli, family names carved on the lintels. These were nothing like the outlandish headstones of assassinated gangsters or murdered journalists or martyred dissidents in Novodevichy Cemetery in Moscow, with startlingly realistic images of the departed carved into the marble. Where would President Putin be laid to rest in Moscow, she wondered? Would the monsters resting in the Kremlin wall scoot over to make room for him? Or would he prefer a 20-story porphyry obelisk on the Moscow hills so he could gaze down on the Rodna he so energetically defended? At Dominika's thought of Putin, the warming sun went behind a cloud and she felt a cold shiver. It was utterly quiet now, no birds, no traffic noise, as if the spirits knew what was happening. The grass around the gravestone stirred. She heard whispers around her, or was that the breeze? But there was no breeze. Get a hold of yourself, she thought as she walked. Keep your head. Meet this bitch and let's complicate Vladimir Putin's life. Dominika kept left and followed the footpath into a dark forested section with very little sunlight. It smelled cold here, and she pushed her sunglasses onto the top of her head. Her hand drifted into her purse and around the shaft of the tactical steel pen in the side pocket. She looked left and right into the trees, her Russian imagination conjuring up wolves weaving through the coppice, keeping pace with her. She rounded a bend in the path and saw the massive wrought-iron lynch gate, the entrance to the private cemetery grounds of the Vanderbilt family. The gate was secured with a heavy-duty chain, but Dominika followed the boundary wall 10 meters to the right and was able to hitch up her dress and boost herself over. The path curved left, and the woods opened up to a grassy clearing ringed by a low-curved curb. The white stone mausoleum at one end dominated the space. It resembled the front of a Romanesque church, with 3 arched doors, a tall central gable, and 2 conical cupolas on the roof. The crypt itself extended from the ornate facade into the earthen hill behind. It was deathly quiet, the sun behind the clouds. Dominika stood still and watched the woods, listened to the air around her. There would have been no way for Gable to set up on this spot without spooking Susan. The veteran illegal knew what she was doing picking this site. Dominika checked her watch. It was time. She walked up the 5 curving steps to the entrance and pushed on the central steel door with matching ornate handles. Dominika knew the crypt doors normally would be locked and probably chained, but mechanical locks posed no problems, ever. The door swung in easily, soundlessly, and a fetid breath of cold stone hit her, a coffin smell, a whiff of endless time. The dim vaulted room was flanked by wall crypts with stone coffins, and a massive tomb with a curved top and adorned with intricate carved decorations. Presumably the sarcophagus of the paterfamilias dominated the center of the chamber.
Dobry den tovarish, good afternoon, comrade,
said a silky voice in Russian. Dominika willed herself not to jump. Gripping the fighting spike in her pocket, she turned slowly toward the voice and saw a dark silhouette in the corner of the crypt, completely in shadow. No halo was visible in this darkness. The only illumination came from the milky bar of light through the cracked central door, keeping most of the room in darkness. "You are precisely on time, but that is to be expected from the famous Colonel Igorova." Moscow accent, educated but originally from the south, with a trace of Yakanye, the broad vowels of the lower Volga, thought Dominika. "Good afternoon. I'm glad we could meet," said Dominika, holding out her hand. "Will you come closer to shake?" The woman didn't move, and Dominika lowered her hand. "How much time do you have? I presume we both have to return to Manhattan tonight," said Dominika. She had a mild goal of getting the woman to talk a little, to see what she could learn, but carefully. "This Staten Island is a strange place." The silhouette shrugged. "It is remote, quiet, and parochial. I find it well suited for operations," she said. "Okay, you operate here. Interesting." "I would find all of New York operationally challenging," said Dominika. "One becomes accustomed to the rhythms of the city," said the woman, vaguely. "She isn't going to volunteer anything. She's too smart." "I imagine you do," said Dominika, now talking a little shop between professionals. "But in my assignments I have had to contend with active, hostile opposition on the street. As a civilian, you, of course, have greater latitude to operate than does a diplomat officer in the Residentura." The silhouette shifted slightly. "I suppose so. The magazine industry has provided effective cover over the years," said Susan. "It fortuitously is dominated by savvy and aggressive women. Our timorous male counterparts are less dynamic. Still, there are disadvantages. Dealing with writers can be a trial you have no idea. This is going nowhere. Back to business. I have the devices, one each for you and Magnet, which will provide secure voice communications. If you need to meet personally, you are to coordinate with Line S. I imagine there are ample discrete sites, equidistant from New York and Washington," said Dominika. She slid the zippered pouch with the echo phones across the dusty curved lid of Commodore Vanderbilt's sarcophagus, half expecting to hear him complain from inside about being disturbed in his sleep, by Russians, no less. "Magnet has less latitude for travel than I," said Susan, "and Washington is an easier counterintelligence environment even within the city." "Okay, you meet in Washington in the city. Benford will be glad to learn that." "Is there anything else I can do for you?" asked Dominika. "Is there anything you or the asset requires? A long shot? What couldn't Magnet obtain in the United States that SVR could? Gold bullion? Blood diamonds? Polonium?" "No more questions. Maybe walk out into the sunlight with her, a glimpse of her halo."
"Spasibo, there is nothing I require," said Susan, condescension edging into her voice.
Then Dominika saw the smear of dust on the sarcophagus lid where she had slid the zippered pouch, and her thoughts raced.
"Then I have a requirement for you," said Dominika sternly, holding her breath, hoping this would work. "I was given a third encrypted mobile phone for contingency use, including for contacting you. I would not like to carry it back to Moscow through airport security. I will pass it to you to dispose of securely the night before I return home. I, of course, could myself throw it into the river, but that kind of haphazard destruction has proven to be disastrous in past cases. Equipment has been recovered by the opposition. You must melt the chip, break apart the handset, and disperse the pieces widely so they will not be associated with each other. Passing the phone to you would not require another personal meeting. I will emplace it at a timed drop of your choosing."
"There are a million places in the city where you can dispose of a phone," said Susan pettishly. She'd been on her own for 20 years, met by servile Line N handlers who never questioned her. Dominika put some menace into her voice, the vocal grit all Russians recognize as looming trouble. "Your long record of service in America, how many years has it been? Undoubtedly has given you encyclopedic knowledge of the city, which is precisely why I'm enlisting your assistance.
given that your own contact numbers are on the instrument. It, moreover, is an operational requirement that we do this," said Dominica flatly. The shadow of the woman stirred, clearly nettled at being told what to do.